Myrtle Beach is the beach. 60 miles of bright sand, water, and a wealth of wonderful music playing day and night. You can step into a simple beach bar and discover a surprising level of exciting musical talent. A place to kick back and groove to the enticing soundtrack of the most unexpected vacations around. With nothing but good vibes floating through the warm ocean air. Plan your own music-filled trip to America's Jukebox at visitmyrtlebeach.com.
Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Now available on Apple Podcasts, Podcast One, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts.
Since 1983, Eddie Trunk has been the voice for fans of rock, hard rock, and heavy metal. A best-selling author, host of TV's That Metal Show, and seven national radio shows, including Trunk Nation, daily on Sirius XM.
Interesting.
Eddie offers the world his news-making interviews, passionate analysis, honest commentary, and who knows what else. So welcome to the Eddie Trunk Podcast.
Welcome, everybody. It's Eddie Trunk, and it's time for another episode of the Eddie Trunk Podcast, which is new every Thursday at podcast1.com, Apple Podcast, and of course, now free on Spotify as well. Be sure to subscribe. Be sure to spread the word. Be sure to check it out and listen for new episodes and new interviews coming your way in the world of rock and metal every single Thursday. Hope everybody's doing well. Hope everybody's having a good week. Hope you enjoyed the last couple weeks of interviews, including, of course, a huge one with Lars Ulrich last week. Before that, 2 weeks back, check out Steve Gorman from the Black Crowes and the great stories he told. Remember, if you miss anything, grab it before it disappears. It's all there for you to download, stream completely free on the outlets that I just mentioned. And remember, all of the interviews you hear, unless otherwise designated, like the Steve Gorman one, which was a podcast exclusive, originated on my Sirius XM radio show. Be sure to join me for live talk and interviews in the world of rock every single day on Sirius XM channel 106. That is volume. You can hear me live each weekday, 2 to 4 p.m. Eastern time, nightly replays of the show, 10 to midnight Eastern time. And full shows, audio, video, and more on demand on the Sirius XM app. The interviews you hear on this show originated on the Volume show on Sirius XM, and they are aired here on the podcast, courtesy of Trunk Nation on Volume Channel 106. Want to also say a big thank you to everybody who wished me a happy birthday as I celebrated my 56th birthday last Saturday. I got a ridiculous amount of tweets and texts and emails and all sorts of wonderful stuff from artists and listeners and fans and friends and each and every one of you. I apologize if I couldn't respond. There were just that many, but no, I do greatly appreciate it and meant a lot to me. It really did. So thank you for that. If you'd like personalized videos from me, you can get them on Cameo. I am on Cameo, so be sure to check it out. Check out my profile at cameo.com. Maybe a special birthday greeting or fans of That Metal Show or fans of the podcast or the radio show or a certain band. You can order those videos from me, personalized however you want to whoever you'd like to give it to. All the info is at cameo.com. Little tip, if you order directly from the cameo.com site versus an app, you are saving $5. So just a little heads up on that. Remember, follow me on social media. At Eddie Trunk, Twitter, fan page on Facebook, and Instagram as well. And the official online home is eddietrunk.com, and you will see all sorts of music news updated on a daily, hourly basis in the world of rock in all one handy location. All access members of my website, you get my show on demand anytime you want, and there's a lot of other cool stuff up there on the site for you to check out as well. So be sure to visit, be sure to bookmark it, be sure to check out all your music news up there on the site. I generally keep this podcast just focused on the interviews, and we have two for you this week, but I did want to mention real quickly, and again, stuff that's topical, stuff that happens on a daily basis, that's the stuff I discuss in depth with the audience and give you my thoughts on it on Trunk Nation, on my daily radio show. But I did, you know, for those outside of America or Canada or those that don't have Sirius or XM, I couldn't let the week go by without mentioning the passing of super producer Martin Birch. If you are a fan of hard rock or metal music in any way, you no doubt have Martin Birch produced albums in your collection. His resume is mind-blowing. He did every single classic Maiden album. It was basically Maiden's right hand through all of their classic period. Martin Birch passing away at the age of 71 years old. And the most astonishing thing, and I did not know Martin Birch. I'd always hoped to one day interview him, but he was completely retired and checked out from music. So I had assumed that he must have been quite old, especially when you consider he produced like or worked on Machine Head by Deep Purple and In Rock by Deep Purple and records from like 69, 70, 71. So it would make sense to think that the man was in his late 80s, early 90s, and that's why he retired like 20 years ago. When I found out he was only 71 at the time of his death last Sunday, I was floored. And I guess what I've been able to figure out is he started producing very early at 18, 19 years old, and he retired in his early 40s. Now, I had heard something about maybe he had some issue with his hearing. I don't know if that's for sure or not, but that was one of the reasons why he left the business so early. But I was utterly shocked when I heard he was that young at the time of his death, because I had, you know, just doing the math, I thought he would have been much older. And there was no cause of death given. And obviously, you know, I would have loved to have had the chance to interview him. I tried a couple times over the years, but I was just told he was completely removed from the industry. But everybody from Whitesnake to the Iron Maiden camp to the Dio camp to countless others, Tony Iommi, Geezer Butler, all in the last week have expressed their condolences about this massive, massive loss. Even though he wasn't active anymore and hadn't been for a very long time, the records he made and created are so iconic in the world of hard rock and metal and still sound so unbelievably great. So rest in peace to one of the legendary producers in hard rock music, the legendary Martin Birch. Some news we definitely needed to touch on this week. So again, there's tons of other rock news. See it all on my website. And if you listen every day on Volume, you know we break it all down for you each and every day as it happens on that show. So today, we're going to salute a couple drummers on this week's podcast. Coming up a little later on, Jimmy DeGrasso joins me. Jimmy is a guy that does not and has not done many interviews in his career. Like a lot of guys, during this pandemic, Jimmy is waiting for the virus to clear so he can get out there and play with somebody. But Jimmy DeGrasso has played with a ton of people, from Rat to Black Star Riders to a brief stint, I believe, with Ozzy to Y&T to Suicidal Tendencies to Megadeth. It's amazing the amount of people Jimmy has played with in his career. And he reached out to me month or so ago and said, you know, because of the pandemic and everything, he thought it would be fun to maybe do an interview, and he was up for doing something with me. So I was only too happy to talk to him. Known Jimmy for a very long time. So this was the first time that I can remember, maybe ever, that we did a one-on-one on-the-record interview. And we touch on all of the bands, or just about every band he was a part of. And, you know, Jimmy's a pretty unfiltered guy. He says how he feels about stuff, including how he feels about Rat and what they're doing now currently without Warren DeMartini. He was in Rat at one point. So this is, you know, I think a really... Yeah, I love talking to those guys who you don't hear from all the time, the sort of behind-the-scenes people in this business, the people who have really great stories and really long histories and resumes, but they're just not the marquee guys that you hear from. And I love getting those stories and hearing from those people because they're often very candid and they are very revealing and they have great, great histories. So Jimmy DeGrasso, that's the longer of the two interviews. That is second this week. We lead with Frank Ferrer, who is the current drummer in Guns N' Roses and has been the drummer in Guns N' Roses for, I would think, and he tells us in the interview, I think about 15 years now. And in the interview, we talk with Frank about how he felt when Steven Adler jumped up for a couple songs. And we talk about how he got the gig in GNR and a little bit about his history with the band. And also talk about a new album he has coming out with a band called Pisser, spelled P-S-S-R. And it's really good, punky street rock and roll. It really is. They've released two songs from an album that is coming out in December. Frank has had this band for a long time. And again, with things being in lockdown, it's now time to put some music out with this band. So we'll talk to Frank about Guns N' Roses, his current band, and also his current side band, if you will, Pisser. So great stuff with a current member of GNR. We lead with that. And then second, a great in-depth interview with a guy who's played with a ton of people, drummer Jimmy DeGrasso. So we do a little salute the backbeat on this week's podcast with two drummers. Thought that would be fun. I think you're going to really enjoy both conversations. I thank you for listening, and we'll get into it with Frank Ferrer of Guns N' Roses to lead off right after this on the Eddie Trunk Podcast.
The Eddie Trunk Podcast.
Hey, 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 this is NFL Hall of Famer Ray Lewis. I'm excited to announce my new podcast, Everyday Greatness, the Ray Lewis Podcast. I'll be talking with friends, family members, old teammates, athletes, celebrities, moguls, and guess what? I'll be talking to you. Listen, this is all in the search for everyday greatness. So I'm asking you to come along with me on this ride. Download new episodes of Everyday Greatness, the Ray Lewis Podcast, on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and on PodcastOne.com. It's not what you have, it's what's inside of you that actually inspires greatness.
This is the Eddie Trunk Podcast.
All right, as I mentioned on this week's podcast, two interviews for you. Coming up in just a few minutes, Jimmy DeGrasso has played with everyone. White Lion, Y&T, Megadeth, Suicidal Tendencies, on and on and on. Rat, we touch on all of it coming up in just a few. But first, the current drummer in Guns N' Roses talking about GNR and talking about his side band Pisser and new music they have coming out. Here he is, Frank Ferrer. Enjoy on the Eddie Trunk Podcast.
What's up, Mr. Trunk? It's nice to hear your voice. How you doing?
I'm doing good. And, you know, all things considered, the crazy times we're in, I got nothing to complain about. You are living in L.A., you told me now, right?
Well, yeah, I moved out to L.A. in 2018, but I've since bought a home out in the desert near Palm Springs. So I've been out here for a year, which is pretty good because it's nice and safe away from a lot of people. So, just trying to hunker down just like everybody else.
What facilitated the move to L.A. to be closer to the GNR camp, or just because you just wanted to get out to the West Coast again?
Definitely because I wanted to get closer to Guns N' Roses and be around those guys more, obviously. Second was the last winter, two winters ago, dude, I just got beat down. I just got beat down. And I was just like, that's it. So a combination of both those things.
I hear you. I'm laughing because the reason why I'm bringing this up with Frank is Frank for a long time lived like just a few towns away from me, and I've been wanting to leave this area for like years, but I've got two kids in the school system that are doing well, and I can't right. Until they're out of school. And you know what? I'm at the Jersey Shore. I have a house at the shore, and I'm down here, and I've been spending the summer, and today it's about 83, sunny, probably going to go run right in the water at the beach as soon as I get off the air. So right now, July, August, amazing, no complaints, but I'm with you when January, February rolls around.
Yeah.
It'll be anything
no,
but.
It's beautiful down there. Down by the shore, Jersey is gorgeous. That's beautiful. Yeah, I mean, out here in the desert, we get like, you know, 120. And people complain. They're like, doesn't the heat bother you? And I'm like, 120 or minus 20? I think I'll stay with 120.
I say it all the time. I'll take a couple months of intense heat and sitting in the AC versus chipping ice off of the windshield any day of the week, man. So I know I sound like an old man. When I was younger, I tried to figure out why everybody from New Jersey, New York, moved to Florida when they got older. Now, as I'm about to be 56 in a few days, I'm like, I get it. I'm down with it. I get it. Totally get it.
In the wintertime, parts of your body that you didn't even know existed hurt. Like, things hurt on your body in the wintertime. You're like, what? I didn't know I had muscles there.
Hey, so let me ask you about this record, because I remember a while ago you telling me about this band, and I didn't really have a full awareness of them. And now this record comes out, a couple tracks, videos or what have you, just killed me, because you're just such kick-ass, straight-up, great hard rock music, the type of stuff that I love so much. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, Frank, because I remember you referred to the band as Pisser. Is that the name of the band?
Right.
Yeah, the so band you spell Pisser. It... You spell it P-S-S-R, but it's actually pronounced Pisser, right?
Exactly, because like early on, we got a lot of flack from people telling us that there's no way, you know, like Walmart is not going to put a record that says P-I-S-S-E-R as its title. So we just came up with the P-S-S-R, that way when you look at it, you know, you have to think about it for a second, but it's pronounced Pisser, yes.
Okay, so you were actually, before you joined Guns N' Roses, you were doing this band. Am I correct? Tell me the history of this band.
Right. It's a little long, but basically this arose out of the ashes of this band that Richard Fortus and I were in with the lead singer of Pisser, Eric Jacobson, a band that was on Sony called Honky Toast, which
I remember.
Is different than Pisser. Also straight ahead rock and roll sleaze.
Yes, great record.
Lower East Side vibe, right? So we did that record. We did an album cycle. We got dropped. Richard and I obviously go off to do other things, you know, Psychedelic Furs, Guns N' Roses. Richard, you know, does a ton of stuff. By the way, he produced a new Psychedelic Furs record, which is amazing. And then Eric, the singer of Honky Toast, he started the band Pisser early 2000s. And then whenever Richard and I were in town, we would go play with him, because that's how Honky Toast was kind of the same way. Richard and I were like in the middle of Love Spit Love and all that kind of stuff. And whenever we would come back to New York City, you know, we'll book a gig and we play as Honky Toast. So it's basically the same thing. So Pisser's been around since the early 90s, early 2000s in different forms, always Eric, the lead singer. And then around 2015, we had we came up with a lineup with just four main guys, Rob Bailey, Brett Bass on bass, and Eric and I on drums. And then we played your Christmas show a couple of years ago, didn't we? Like, or it might have been 15 or 16.
Dingbats. Dingbats, I think. Yeah.
Dingbats. Yeah. So pretty much that lineup has been pretty steady since 2015. And then we went and recorded this record, and it sat in a can for a couple of years until it got to Mark, the owner of Golden Robot Records. And he heard it and he loved it and he wanted to put it out. So that's where we're at right now.
So is Fortus in Pisser, or he makes a guest appearance on the record, right?
He makes a guest appearance on the record, yes, sir.
Okay, so this record...
Yeah, Rob Bailey is the main guitar player. I'm sorry?
Okay, and this record is out now, or it's coming out?
The singles are out. We have three singles that are out right now that you can listen to on everything, Spotify, Apple, wherever you want to listen to your music. And then a record should drop, I believe, first week of December. I think December 9th is when the whole album will come out.
Oh, okay. So the full album is a bit down the road. It's the end of the year.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Well, I got to tell you, man, it is just killer raw rock and roll. I mean, I loved it. I loved it. I mean, when I first saw the press releases and the stuff floating around with it, I texted you because it immediately, the name Pisser sticks in your head, because I remember you telling me that you had that band and you were doing it on and off. And then when I finally got to hear it, I was just like, damn, this is killer. So I wanted to have you on to talk a little bit about it. Are you going to be able to do live shows when things resume and get back to normal, or will everybody's schedules not allow that, you think?
Well, that was the plan, right? The plan was to, you know, my downtime with Guns N' Roses in between tours, maybe going out and doing a run with Pisser. That was the plan. Obviously, you know, we're all staying home. We're all wearing masks. We're all social distancing, so which is perfect. And then once we get over this hump, once we get over this virus, then we can get back to normal. Yeah, Pisser's going to play. It's going to play as much as it can. You know, I mean, again, I have a you know, being the Guns N' Roses is a pleasure and an honor and a blessing from the heavens, and it's just something that I love and it's dear to my heart. But this is also something that I want to do, you know, when we're not doing guns, you know.
How, I was talking about this before you joined me on the air. I don't know the timeline on this, but how many years you've been in Guns N' Roses now?
I started in 2006. It was supposed to be temporary, but I pretty much stayed since.
I'd say so. 14. You've been temporary for 14 years, Frank?
Right.
And who did you?
Brain was the,
you replaced Brain, right?
Yes, sir. Yeah. Brain wanted to go off. And first off, he was going to have a child at the time. And since then, he's become a producer and stuff like that. He's still involved with Guns in a lot of ways. He wanted to stay in and be more of a producer, behind the scenes type of guy. And, you know, Guns N' Roses is my wheelhouse. It's exactly the style of drumming I love to play every day. So it's perfect.
How did you get the gig? I mean, how did you audition or did someone recommend you? How did you get the gig?
It was Richard Fortus and Tommy Stinson and Brain to a certain extent. He didn't know me that well, but Richard Fortus and Tommy Stinson brought my name up when they were having a discussion about Brain maybe going out, going home to for the birth of his child, you know. And I've played with Richard since 1992. And when Tommy does his solo stuff and he'd come to New York, I'd go and play with him. So both those guys knew how I played and they thought that I'd be perfect for the gig. So, I mean, I approached it. I thought it was an audition. In my heart, it was an audition. And I approached that way and I prepared, and, you know, and I went and played my ass off. But I did have the backing of Tommy and Richard Fortus.
Yeah, of course, Tommy was the bass player in the band at the time that you joined. Do you remember where, right. Well, you must, where your very first Guns N' Roses show was? Where was the very first performance for you?
It was, I believe it was definitely during the European tour. It escapes you right now. I do remember one thing, though. I remember that Alice in Chains played right before us, and I adore Alice in Chains. I've seen them every single time they played in New York. I actually went to the first gig. They opened up for King's X at the Limelight, Alice in Chains' first show in New York. And it was surreal, you know, standing there, getting the drums set up to my specs, and having Alice in front of the curtain. There's a curtain in front of our stage. Alice in Chains playing in front of the stage and playing all my favorite songs. So I do remember me being it was like an out of body experience in that very moment. And that's when it all really hit me, like, oh, this shit is coming down right now. This is some real stuff. So I mean, right now it escapes me where Europe it was, maybe Switzerland. I'm not sure right now. I can't remember. But I do remember that moment, though, hearing Alice and getting ready to play the show. You know?
Yeah, man, that's amazing. And you and Richard and Dizzy have the vantage point of having been in GNR prior to the reunion and the gargantuanness that's gone on since Slash and Duff came back. You were in with other guys. You were in with Ashba. You were in with Bumblefoot, all the guys before. And now you're seeing what's happening now. For you as a player, what's been the biggest changes? Because when Duff and Slash come back, and as the band is currently constituted, there's been a few people that said that they worked with you and that there were some changes they wanted to make to the way the stuff was being played. Can you talk about that a little bit? Like, how did it impact you as a drummer with the lineup change and the reunion happening?
Well, I mean, the best way I could explain that is that I really had to work hard to make sure I was able to represent the Adler's feel, Matt Storm's feel, and Brain/Josh Freeze feel of the Chinese Democracy stuff. So that was the toughest challenge, was trying to get all three eras of Guns N' Roses, if you may, and bringing them all together to one cohesive, way of playing the material. So that was the toughest part. So that, there was changes that, you know, I mean, Slash and Duff, they have a certain feel, you know, they have a certain ear for the music. And those three drummers, you know, Brain, Adler, and Soham, are really three different kind of drummers. So that was the toughest part. The most challenging part was trying to bring those three entities together somehow to make it like nice and cohesive and have everything flow, you know?
Yeah, I mean, you got a lot of ground to cover. And for people that have seen Guns N' Roses recently, it's a long set. I mean, it's not unusual for it to be a three-hour show, so it's a bit of an endurance test for the drummer, especially because you don't really get to go anywhere, right?
Yeah, it is. It's tough, but like I said before, man, I wouldn't have it any other way. I just love it. What can I say? The greatest thing I've ever done in my life, you know?
And, you know, you mentioned Adler. What was it like for you the time, you know, Steven made a couple guest appearances since this all happened. How was that for you? Was that, as a fan of the band, was that cool for you to watch him for a song or two?
Absolutely. And to be there and seeing the audience, the crowd, that energy that came when Adler came and sat down, I thought it was very special. On a different level, I think it might have even been some sort of healing for everybody involved. You know what I mean? Adler's sweet. He's a sweet guy. Steven is a sweet guy. He's a puppy dog, you know? So it's nice to see him and have him around. And I'm glad he had that moment. And I think the crowd, you could feel the emotion in the crowd. I thought it was nice. I had no problem with it. Steven is a really sweet man. I really like him a lot.
Yeah, he really is. And he's a wonderful guy. And I thought that was great that he had that opportunity. And I would think that just as a fan, you know, it would be cool to just say, here's the sticks for a couple songs and, you know, watch him do his thing. Because I know he was like a kid in a candy store about it as well. So that's really cool that you felt that way. So, again, the band is what were you going to say, Frank? I'm sorry.
No, I'm just agreeing with you. Yeah, it was good. It was a good thing.
For you, and I know for Guns, the dates have already been announced, everything pushed to next year. So I imagine, like everybody, you guys are just in a holding pattern, right?
We're all of us are staying home, wearing a mask, wearing our masks, social distancing. You know, we're all sitting down waiting for this thing to be over. Everybody is in a holding pattern. The whole world is pretty much, you know, so it's no different for us. You know, I mean, I can speak for myself. It's no different for me. You know, I'm staying in. I don't want to get sick. I don't want to get anyone else sick.
And I don't know what you can and can't say about this, but I got to ask you that the world obviously is asked continually about new music from Guns, depending upon who you talk to. Fortis has said some stuff. Slash has said stuff. Duff has said stuff. Everyone said they'd like to make it. Is there anything you can report on that front?
I can't really say much about it. I would just let management, when everything is ready to be said, I'll just let management make those announcements. You know, I mean, okay. Sooner than later, it's about as much as I can say about it.
All right, and just for everybody, so for everybody on back to Pisser here, the guys in this band, give everybody the rundown of who they're hearing besides you on drums.
Sure, Brett Bass on bass, play with some heavy dudes, Bernie Worrell and Greg Allman, Rob Bailey on guitar, New York session guy, also play with some heavies, David Johansen and others. Eric Jacobson, who was the lead singer of Pisser, of Hockey Toast for a long time, and now Pisser, and myself on drums. And the song's about exactly what the title is, about being busted. Nobody likes to get busted.
Well, I got to tell you, man, it's killer. To me, this one screams of like AC/DC. It's got that kind of vibe to it.
100%. I mean, it's exactly in our wheelhouse. We're Lower East Side guys. you know, Stooges, Dictators, AC/DC, you know, New York Dolls. Yes, that's exactly what this is.
Well, listen, man, it's always good to check in with you for a little bit. Stay well there in Southern California. When times are normal, I was coming out there every month, so I'll definitely hit you up whenever I can get back out on a plane and get out there again. It'd be good to see you. And
yes,
congrats on this, man. It's really cool. And everybody check out the singles now. Full album coming in December. And if you're looking for it online, it's spelled P-S-S-R. It is seriously kick-ass. I'll let you run, Frank. Thank you for the time, man. I appreciate it. Frank is a great guy. Great to catch up with him. Great to talk to him for a bit. Couple songs out now from his band Pisser. Full album, as you heard, coming in December. And who knows, you know, who knows with GNR? He would not talk about whether GNR are doing new music or not. Depending upon who you ask, you get a different answer on that. I've said consistently, if you don't get new music from Guns N' Roses coming off of the quarantine, where everybody in the world is making and writing new music during this downtime, you definitely aren't getting new music from GNR anytime soon. But we'll see. We'll see. All right, we'll come back and do our second interview on this Double Dip podcast. Another tremendous drummer and a guy who's played with everybody. Jimmy DeGrasso is up next.
Hey, hey, hey. This is NFL Hall of Famer Ray Lewis. I'm excited to announce my new podcast, Everyday Greatness. The Ray Lewis Podcast. I'll be talking with friends, family members, old teammates, athletes, celebrities, moguls. And guess what? I'll be talking to you. Listen, this is all in the search for everyday greatness. So I'm asking you to come along with me on this ride. Download new episodes of Everyday Greatness, the Ray Lewis Podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and on PodcastOne.com. It's not what you have, it's what's inside of you that actually inspires greatness.
Eddie Trunk back with you, saluting the drummers this week on the Eddie Trunk Podcast. Our second interview is with drummer Jimmy DeGrasso. I already mentioned his resume. He's played with a ton of people. Don't really hear from him much. Doesn't really do many interviews, so I think you're really going to enjoy some of these stories. Some great candid stuff in here. Enjoy Jimmy DeGrasso on the Eddie Trunk Podcast. How are you, brother?
Hey, Ed, how are you, man? When you started talking about summertime songs, I'm like, I know where he's going here.
Well, you know, I'm sure you were getting right into it. I'm sure you were a Y&T fan before you joined the band. I remember being a Y&T fan and like hearing that song and being thrilled for them that they had a hit single, but also being like, this ain't Black Tiger, man.
Yeah, no, it's funny. I thought the same thing. I remember seeing them, you know, going back, you know, because we're all sort of older now. I remember watching when MTV used to have concerts on, I think, Saturday night. They would have live concerts on, you know, and they had Y&T Live. And I remember seeing that back, I don't know, it had to be like 83, 84, yeah, or something like that. And then I went to Europe for a while. I was moving around there. I was playing with Ozzy and that other band, Mama's Boys, I played with. And we were on the tour bus, and they had a live video of Y&T from Pink Pop Festival, of all places.
And that's a pretty legendary show in Y&T history, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's one of those, and it's, and then like about 10 months later, I was in the band. I never really sort of even envisioned that. It was just kind of like, well, okay, cool. So.
Well, obviously, yeah, no, you know, there's a lot I want to talk to you about, but you know, since we just touched on the Y&T stuff, and I told people earlier, you and I have been friends for a really long time. I see you out at shows, yeah, and all these different bands you played with, and we've never done this where we just shot the shit on the air. So I'm glad we're able to do it, because I love these conversations. It's not about promoting any certain thing. It's just about, you know, two rock fans talking. And in your instance, a guy that's played with a slew of bands. But when you got the gig in Y&T, those were big shoes to fill coming in for Leonard Hayes, who you knew everybody loved as a drummer. So what was your approach there? I mean, were you going to come in and be Jimmy DeGrasso doing your thing, or were you there to sort of honor what Leonard had done as well?
Well, no, the thing with it from the get go, you know, our styles are completely different in a lot of ways. And when I came in, Dave and Phil and Joey were just like, do your thing. Do not do that thing. And that was no disrespect to Leonard by any means, but you know, they just wanted something else. And I'm like, all right, well, I'll just do what I do. And, you know, so, you know, I played his part in the previous records. I played pretty much verbatim for the most part. But, you know, then moving forward, because at the time, you know, even Dave was like, hey, can you do double bass stuff? He wanted to do, like, double bass shuffles and different things like that that they weren't doing previously, you know, just to change it up a bit. I'm like, yeah, I could do all that. So that's kind of the way, you know, I approached it. I just did what I did and then played his parts pretty much what they were, and then we just moved forward.
And you made a bunch of studio records with the band in your own right, starting with Contagious. And, of course, a year or so ago, maybe a little less, the Y&T documentary came out, which you're a big part of, and you're in that story quite a bit. What did you think of the film, and what did you think of how'd you feel about watching it?
You know, I was apprehensive about doing it, but you know what? The people that produced it, I thought they did a really, really good job. I remember watching it for the first time and going, wow, this is, you know, this is real stuff. I mean, they pretty much depicted it the way it was. And I thought the production was really good. And it was funny because, you know, obviously it took me back a long time when you go back and reflect on the things that you've done. And it was cool. I mean, it was nothing but good. I mean, there's no part that makes me cringe. I mean, there wasn't anything really negative in it. I mean, you know, if anything, it just made me sad because, like, everybody except for me and Dave and Steph are gone.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really, you know, it's hard to believe that everybody from the original band, of course, except Dave, is no longer with us. And Phil was, it was great. When I watched it, I was like, well, at least that, thankfully, they made this while Leonard and Joey were still alive so that they are represented in it in new interviews. Unfortunately, that's not the case for Phil, but I was glad that they got that in when they did, because if they had waited a little longer to do it, you'd have nobody but you and Dave and Steph in it, really.
Yeah, no, yeah, I'm glad they got that. The whole, yeah, man, there was a few years there. They were just brutal. I remember I was on a Black Star Rider tour in England, and I was in my bunk, and I think it was like 3 or 4 in the morning. We were driving, and of course, the two guys were up downstairs for a wake, and one of them woke me up. They're like, "Did you hear Joey Alves pass?" And I'm like, "No, I was asleep." And I'm like, "Jesus, like, what next?" Like, it's like, you know, everybody. It's just really sad. And I remember when I got back, I was only back a few days, and me and Dave went to his memorial service here. And, yeah, it's just a drag, man. I mean, that's the one thing that brought back. It's like, I remember all the times riding in the studio with those guys and playing and traveling, and then, you know, to realize that, you know, they're all gone for the most part. It's just a bummer. But, you know, it's life. It's just what it is.
Well, let's talk. I mean, there's a lot I want to talk about in your career, and we have, you know, we have this hour, which is already rapidly going by. So I want to get some stuff from you. Now, your story is you started, you're an East Coast guy. You're from Bethlehem, PA, and relocated to the West Coast. Did you go to LA like most musicians chasing the dream back in the 80s?
Yeah, but, you know, it was a little bit different. I had been playing in that the tri-state area, that New Jersey, New York, Pennsylvania, Delaware area, for about, you know, 4 or 5 years since I was like a junior in high school. And, you know, I did it all. I did, you know, Hammer Jacks and Lemieux and, you know, all the places we used to go to. And, you know, I thought, oh, it's got to be something else. So I just figured I'll go to L.A. And I actually wanted to start a fusion band. It wasn't even about a rock thing. I wanted to go there and do like a jazz rock thing or something like that. And I was living there for about 5 or 6 months, and I was breaking into the session scene. I was doing a lot of recording at like Rumbo and A&M, and doing jingles and like demos for artists and production deals for record companies. And the place I was living at, I ran into this guy, and we were hanging out one night, and he goes, hey, you know, Ozzy's auditioning drummers, I think, in the next couple of days. And I'm like, okay, that was strange, because from last I heard, Tommy Aldridge was playing drums with him, and Tommy's, like, great. So I'm like, all right, I'm not sure what happened there. And so I called him up, and they invited me down, and
they had this huge cattle call audition, and I wound up with Alice like what, 2 weeks later in the UK.
See, I never knew you, as well as I know you, I never knew you toured with Ozzy. And I read, and tell me if this is wrong, but I read online that you play on The Ultimate Sin?
No, I did not. See, here's the deal. What happened was they flew me over to the UK, and Ozzy and Sharon had a house in London, and the band at the time was me, Jakey Lee, and Bob Daisley, okay? So we had our own house on the Thames. It was great. We had this great place. And we all had our own floor. So we were there writing and recording for about, I don't know, about 2 months. And, you know, obviously, as always, there was some discord in the camp. But we recorded about, I think it's either 5 or 6 songs. And we did them with Chris Tangredis, who actually did Y&T Black Tiger, you know. Small world. So we recorded these 5 or 6 songs, and then Bob and Ozzy had a falling out, and Bob was let go. And then we had a couple other bass players come in. At one time, we had Neil Murray from Whitesnake. So it was me and Jake and Neil Murray from Whitesnake. And, you know, we kept writing and we kept writing, and then, you know, we kept working on songs. And it's funny because I have all these rehearsal room tapes. And some of those songs, I think, actually wound up on the first Badlands record.
Oh, is that right? So Jake had some stuff that didn't make it on Ultimate Sin that he repurposed when he did Badlands.
Right, exactly. So, and then at one point, the tour manager came over to the house and said, hey, listen, we're really not sure where we're going from here. Ozzy was going to go back and play with Sabbath and do the Live Aid show in Philadelphia. So you can go home for a while. We'll let you know if we need you again. And that was the end of it. That's just, okay, thanks. Bye.
How many gigs did you do with Ozzy, Jimmy?
No, we didn't do any gigs. We were all in the studio all the time. We were writing and we were recording. So, and then basically what happened, so we had half the album done with Chris Tangredis, and then Epic Records wanted Ron Nevison to produce the records, who had a lot of success, I believe. I think he did the last couple Heart records or something like that.
Yep.
So Ron came in later, and then they hired a whole new band, except for Jake. They hired Phil and Randy Castillo, which was totally fine. And they did the record again. So basically, Randy just, and I talked to Randy about this years later, he just basically took all my charts and just charted them out and played. You know, and then they did another 4 or 5 songs on top of that. And it was fun.
Well, that's pretty wild, though. So you go to the West Coast to sort of chase the dream as a young musician, and you end up finding yourself pretty quickly in England doing pre-production on an Ozzy record. So it's off to a pretty good start. Where did you go from there?
Well, so what happened after that, I came home, and I was only home for like a month or two, and I started playing with like a reformed version of Talus that Billy Sheen had just left to go play with David Lee Roth. So that was a reform. And so it was Phil Narrow, Al Petrelli, Bruno Ravel, I'm sure you know, and myself. So we went out on the road and started doing dates with that. And then a couple months later, I got a call from Y&T's manager. And I'm not sure where they got my number. And he goes, do you have any recording stuff? I'm like, yeah, I just sent him all the Ozzy stuff. And then, you know, they invited me to come out, and then the rest went from there.
Yeah,
but
I mean,
somewhere in between there, I have to back up a sec. So after the Ozzy thing, I was home for a couple weeks, and I got a call from a manager in England again that managed that band Mama's Boys, right? Which was like a three brothers. They were sort of like a blues rock band.
I think they were from Scotland. And,
no, they're Ireland.
Oh, Ireland,
County,
okay.
County Cork. Yep. Yes. So, and the reason they got my name is because Chris Tangredis did their record, and they needed a drummer because their brother was ill. So we need someone to come out and do this tour. It was like 3 months in Europe opening for Gary Moore. So I'm like, yeah, sure. So I went over there, and the funny thing is, by that time, Bob Daisley was now playing with Gary Moore.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, where so did, it was basically, you know, Bob.
Where did I remember, because I worked for White Lions management for a brief time, and those guys were friends of mine for a really long time. So I remember when Greg and James left and that tour happened and they replaced the rhythm section and you were the drummer. You didn't play on a White Lion record, but you went out and toured with them. And and that was a rough time because that's early 90s when the wheels are coming off on that scene and White Lion was hanging on for dear life. And you went out and did that tour. Talk about that experience because that, you know, the band literally broke up on stage. I mean, I think Vito said, or Mike said, this is our last show and we're done. And so it was a rough time to be in a band like that, I'm sure. But talk about that experience.
It was, you know, the tour was cool. I mean, you know, Tommy, the bass player, was a friend of mine for a while. And I knew Mike and Vito because they used to open for YNT on the Contagious tour. So we did like a month or two or something like that. And then, it was really bizarre because I said, why you guys want to break up? I know it's a weird time, but this is kind of the time to just sort of refocus or take a break. But they decided to just break up. And while they're selling a lot of records, it didn't make sense to me. And it still doesn't to this day. But I mean, as far as the vibe of playing, we always, that's the one thing. We had fun. The vibe was good. I don't know what the subplots are between Mike and Vito. That's a whole different story. But it was great. And then, you know, I literally went home. I think I was home like a day. And then I got a call from Alice Cooper to do Wayne's World.
Which, so you're in Wayne's World. There. You're in his band, right? You're in the scenes with him when he's playing with the band.
Yes. Yeah.
So that led to a history with Alice. So you do Wayne's World and you did some records with him, right? Talk about all that. I mean, it's got to be pretty cool to, you know, to be in that band in that scene in that movie. That must have been a fun day shooting.
Well, yeah, no, it was a lot of fun. You know, I met Alice years before because they had called me to do the Trash tour, and they flew me up to like Montreal or Toronto. I don't remember. And I was going to start doing the Trash tour, but then it got to be where there was, because I was still in YNT at the time, and there was schedule conflicts with YNT shows and Alice Cooper shows. So I had to fulfill all my YNT stuff, so I couldn't do it. So a couple of years later, he called me to do Wayne's World. And, it's funny because, you know, when they called me to do that, I had no idea. I saw the Wayne's World skit on Saturday Night Live, and I thought it was cool. It was funny. But I, you know, no one had any clue that was going to become the big cult hit that it is. You know what I mean?
Mm. What was the experience like being on the set for that? Were any stories or anything funny about doing it, or any memories that jump out at you from actually being in the film?
No, the one thing that was funny, you know, like we lip synced obviously to that one song, "Feed My Frankenstein." We did it about, I want to say, 8 or 9 times. And it was cool, you know, because all here again, Steph in YNT was in Alice's band at the time, and Greg Smith was already a friend of mine. So, like, it was just kind of hanging out with your friends. The vibe was really chill. I just remember we had to do this dressing room scene, and Penelope, the director, came up to me, and she goes, "Okay, this is the scene. You're going to be backstage drinking a beer and talking to a girl." I'm like, "Okay." I don't think I need much coaching on that. And she's like, try to look engaged. I'm like, "Oh, okay, thanks." Like, all right, thank you.
And did that version of Alice's band, I didn't realize, so that band was Greg Smith, who I didn't even know played with Alice, who plays with Nugent now. And so it was Greg Smith. It was Steph Burns, who was in YNT for a short time. But I think Steph, and you see this in the YNT doc, Steph has this whole huge career, I think, outside of America somewhere as a musician.
Yes.
And then you, that did that Alice Cooper band ever make a record or tour that lineup?
Oh, yeah. So Alice, I think this is the end of 91. I don't think Alice toured after that till about 95, because then right after that, I joined Suicidal Tendencies, and I toured to the end of 95 with them. And I remember being in Australia, and Alice's assistant called me. I have no idea how he got my
hotel information in Australia, but he called me, he goes, Alice wants to go do South America. Do you want to do it? And I said, yeah, great. So it was basically me and Steph, Greg Smith, and Paul Taylor was playing keyboards and guitar. So, like, right after I got home from Australia, then I flew back down to South America and rehearsed with that. So, yeah, we did some shows, and ironically, we were opening for Megadeth, I think.
Well, it's great. I mean, Alice is, you know, always has unbelievable bands, and that's a killer lineup. I didn't actually see that lineup happen, but that is an unbelievable lineup. Jimmy, I want to jump to Megadeth because you put a lot of time in with Megadeth. Talk about landing that gig.
It was pretty simple. I mean, you know, I had known Dave for a long time, and he approached me several times about, hey, you know, maybe you should join the band. And I said, yeah, you know, it's something to talk about for sure. I mean, at some point, if it runs its course, as you're thinking. And then I remember I was did you watch that series on ESPN, The Last Dance with the Bulls?
Yes.
Okay. I was watching the last Bulls in 98. I remember, and I was in Frankfurt, because it was on at like 3 in the morning or something like that. And Dave called me in my hotel room and goes, hey, I want you to join the band. I'm like, all right, well, I'm in Frankfurt. I'll be home in like 2 or 3 days. We'll talk about it then. He goes, no, I need you to start like Tuesday. And I'm like, I don't even get home till Monday night. So I said, I have to be home more than 12 hours to figure this out. And so he goes, okay, how about can you start Thursday? So I figured, okay, if I get home Monday, I don't even know if my drums can make it back in time. So at least I can get on the phone with the drum company, get another drum kit sent out quick and do something. And basically what happened is, you know, this is before the internet, I went to a record store in like Germany and bought all the Megadeth CDs and I learned them in like 3 days. And I went down, we started in Fresno. I got home Monday night around midnight and I started, I think, Wednesday night in Fresno. And we had a 10-minute sound check and that was it.
Wow. What was your history with Mustaine and what was the experience like being in the band with him for a pretty good period of time doing a few records there? I mean, you know, there's a lot of people. I've known Dave forever and I like him and I've never had a bad experience with him. Sure. But obviously you hear things from other people and there's been a lot of turnover in Megadeth over the decades. How did you find, you said sure. You knew him for a while before you joined the band, but when you were working with him, how did you find the experience?
You know what? We got along for the most part. I mean, obviously we disagreed. I mean, when you're in a band, obviously, you know, you've seen this for 40, 50 years. It's like a marriage and you don't always get along, but me and him, for the most part, always get along. The one thing about him, he always had a really great work ethic. Like, we worked. Like, when we worked, like, we were working. Like, there was no, you know, if we could have done 3 shows in a day, we would have done them. So that's the one thing I take from that. Like, you know, we never turned down work, and we never shied away from working hard. And he's, you know, the one thing he's gifted with, he's extremely creative. Like, you know, some of those licks he comes up with are just like ridiculous, you know, when you listen back to some of those records. And we used to, like, the last record, studio record we did, World Needs a Hero, we wrote most of that right on the spot. And we literally wrote that in the studio, a lot of it. And he would just come up with these licks. And we would just kind of like, me and him, we just kind of like jam and then like just throw it on tape. And, you know, but for the most part, listen, you know, obviously there were things behind the scenes, you know, there always is. And then Marty left and, you know, but for the most part, I went back a couple of years ago and looked at some of the clips on YouTube and the band's great. I mean, then Al Petrelli came in here again and he was great, you know, the whole thing. But, you know, Dave had some issues at the end and he had to take some time off.
You correct me if I'm wrong, but was your first album with Megadeth? I know you did the MD45 thing, but was the first Megadeth album you did Risk?
Yes. Yeah.
So that, needless to say, with Megadeth fans, is a much maligned record because it was such a left turn from what Megadeth normally did. What were your thoughts on that? I mean, obviously, you're the new guy. You're not going to have a say in direction or music. But take us inside of what went on making Risk, which is such a, you know, there's some fans that like it, but for the most part, a very polarizing Megadeth record and kind of like their sort of asterisk record.
Yeah. Asterisk. Thank you. You know, I was dead set against it. Like, when we started getting to the songwriting process, which was like late 98, we were in the studio for a couple months, and they wanted to do something completely different. And that's not to say that that's a bad record. I actually think that's a good record. There's some great songs on that, like The Doctor's Calling, Red Line, Prince of Darkness. There's some really good songs. It's just that I had just left Alice Cooper, and I had already sort of been doing that genre of music. I wanted to do a really heavy, like, metal record, you know? And so I get into Megadeth, and they wanted to do, like, sort of a commercial mid-tempo record. I'm like, yeah, I've been doing that. Like, I don't want to do that. But you have to succumb to that because, you know, those guys had been there a long time, and that was their creative thought process behind it. So I went with it, and I was, you know, it wasn't what I wanted to do, but, you know, you have to respect that because, you know, they put the time in, you know, they've had the band, and they've been working for all these years, and that's what they wanted to try. It was just so weird that, you know, I left sort of like a classic rock artist because I wanted to go do sort of like a more of a metal thing, thrash thing again, like Suicidal, and then it wound up being what I just left.
So when you're there again, you're the new guy coming into that, but Marty is still there, Dave obviously is there, Ellefson is there. Was everybody else in the band, you know, fully on board with the change in direction, or was everybody down with what was going on with Risk or at that time?
Thanks for that question. I wasn't down with it, but I was committed to making it as good as it could be. And Marty...
I meant the vibe amongst the other guys while you were making it. Was everybody like all in at that time? Or was there anybody that had been in the band for a while, like Marty or Ellefson, saying, well, I'm not so sure about this?
No, they were kind of down with it. That, you know, they were cool trying something new. That's the thing about, I remember with Marty, he likes different styles of music. So he liked doing things outside of the thrash metal thing. He wanted to try something different. And I think to a degree, so did Dave, because he'd been doing the same thing for a long time. And David, I think, was fine with it. I mean, it was kind of interesting to play sort of a different style of music to a degree. But no, there was no fighting or anything, if that's what you're trying to find. We would hash out ideas. There's a few things that didn't make the record, but, you know, it was just like, we're going to do something different, and management wanted us to do something different, and musically at the time, it was really a non-metal AOR scene. You know, it wasn't like, even though Cryptic Writings got played a lot on the radio, it was kind of a time where it was just really strange. So we figured, well, if we're going to do something different, I guess we should do it now.
How did you end up with the gig in Suicidal Tendencies? Because given the world of music that you were doing and the artists you were affiliated with, how did that come about? Maybe not what people would immediately associate with you as, you know, for a band to join.
That was a weird one. There was a time, I think it was the middle of 92. I had been home from touring for about 3 months, and that was the longest time I ever had off. It's like, wow, 3 months at home. And I thought, well, you know, whatever. I mean, maybe, you know, my time's done and maybe the phone won't ring again. And I woke up one morning and I went riding and I came home and the phone rang and it was a management company. I can't remember the name of them, but they're like, hey, we represent the Cult. they need a drummer. Would you like to come down to L.A. and play? And I sort of laughed because at this time, the Cult was going to drummers like every 6 months. And I'm like, okay, that's fine. I'll be down in L.A. on Monday. So, and then about an hour later, the phone rings again, and it was Robert Trujillo. And he's like, I got your number from the record company, blah, 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 blah. Suicidal needs a drummer. Will you come down and play? And I said, sure. So I'm like, all right, so I'll be down, you know, Monday. And then an hour later, the phone rings again, and I'm not making this up. I get a call from another manager, and he goes, hi, I'm like so-and-so, so I represent Olivia Newton-John. She's doing a residency in Vegas. And he goes, would you like to come down to L.A. and play? And I'm like, yeah, sure, I'll be there Monday. So a couple days later, so I had to learn, like, literally the Cult's greatest hits and Sonic Temple, Suicidal's catalog, and Olivia Newton-John's greatest hits in
five
days. Just like, and you know, and I was driving to mountain bike races with my buddies, and they're like, why are we listening to Olivia Newton-John? I'm like, it's a long story.
So did you end up playing with her?
Yeah. So basically what happened was, so I went down there, I went to L.A., and first I played with the Cult, and we played like five or six songs. It was cool. And then I went down to Santa Monica, and I played with Olivia's band for like an hour or two, and that was cool. And then I drove back over to North Hollywood, and I played with Suicidal. And then I just drove home. And 2 days later, I get a call from Olivia's manager. And here again, I can't recall his name, but he said, hey, listen, really appreciate your time coming down and learning all the songs. But she's been diagnosed with breast cancer. So everything's canceled. So we're done for the year. Thanks for coming down. Thanks for your time. And I thought that was really cool because you know most managers won't even bother. And I said, hey, listen, send my regards. I hope she gets well soon. And thanks for your time. And then about an hour later, Trujillo called me and goes, hey, you want to join Suicidal? And I said, yeah, sure.
And you were in that band for a while, right?
Yeah, it was like 4 years, I think, until like Mike broke it up. Yeah.
Right. That's so amazing. You're like the Forrest Gump of rock, man. You pop up from Olivia Newton-John to the Cult to Megadeth. It's amazing. It's just really, really incredible. So I mentioned that whole very short-lived thing with Rat, and I remember everybody knows just a few years ago, those guys were in the throes of a big battle with Blotzer over the name, and then they went and came right together with everybody but Blotzer and debuted with you instead of Blotzer and played on that cruise, and we all were hanging out, right, and everybody sort of like, okay, they'd worked so hard to get the band back together, so to speak, in that realm, and it imploded pretty quickly. What's your take on all that?
Yeah, exactly. It was weird, you know, like I played with them back in 2014 when they needed a drummer. I did like three shows with them, and then they sort of went silent, and then all the legal stuff started to happen, and then we all started to talk again. So we decided to come out and play, and of course we started on that Monsters of Rock cruise, which was really cool. And the show, I thought, went really well. You know, we only rehearsed, you know, we rehearsed 3 or 4 days. And then, you know, and then we started to book shows, and then we started to play. And, you know, the odd thing about those guys, it's like there's no fighting. Like there was no fisticuffs in the dressing room or no screaming or any of that stuff. It's just like I don't know what goes on behind the scenes with, the you know, Warren and Steven and Juan. But, you know, so we did pretty much through the end of the summer, and then Steven had to have his knee replaced, which obviously is traumatic. And then we started to talk again, and then the next thing I hear, Warren's not in the band. I'm like, oh, okay. It was, and, you know, honestly, I think you need Warren in that band. And there's no disrespect to anybody, but I mean, you know, the band is Warren and Steven, really, for the most part, I think. I think most fans would agree. And I don't know what legal squabbles are going on behind the scenes. I'm not sure. I don't know if there's even any. I guess it's just a situation where, you know, they just can't coexist. I don't know.
Yeah, Warren's been really silent, and I know, of course, I know all these guys, and I like them all, and they're, you know, I'm rooting for all of them, but it's just hard to figure. And Warren's been totally quiet since everything went down. He hasn't said a peep about any of it. Were you approached? Now, of course, the band exists now, and we're about to go on tour until the virus took it down. But the band exists now with Steven and Juan as the two original guys. Did they approach you, or would you have entertained the idea of being in this lineup?
They did for sure. And we talked and we talked a bit, and, you know, my issue with it is, and like I said, I've made it clear with them. I just think the band's strongest when it's the three of them and Carlos. I mean, even Carlos, Carlos is an amazing guitar player.
Yeah.
And it was a great chemistry there. I mean, you could go on, like I said, it's all public domain. You could go watch the shows from like 17. It's like, they were great. The band was great, and they just, I don't know why they can't keep themselves together. I don't know. I don't know, like the sub politics. And I told them that, and I called you during this time period, because I'm like, I don't want to make a big press release. I just don't think I want to be involved unless it's the real guys.
Yeah, I remember actually you calling me around that time. I didn't know that you played with David Lee Roth either. When was that?
That was in, I think, 2005 to 2007. So it was 5, 6, and 7. And I remember he called me because I was already playing. I had just started playing with Montrose, like started doing like a couple one-offs, because I really, after the Mega thing, I wanted some time off to just kind of like reload. And so I was started doing some gigs with Montrose, and I got this call on a Friday night. I remember we were having a birthday party for the twins and all these screaming babies in my house. And this guy calls and he goes, "Hey, I'm a manager." And I'm like, "Yeah, whatever." And he goes, "Hey, I represent David Lee Roth. Can you do a one-off in Vegas on Monday?" And I'm looking at this kid's birthday party. I'm like, yeah, I think I want to do that. Like, I want to get out of the house for a little bit.
Yeah.
And it was only supposed to be a one-off. I just said, you know, yeah, it's only the one show. That's fine. And so what happened was, he goes, "Well, how many weeks do you need to rehearse?" And I'm like, "Weeks?" I "Read me the set list." And he read me down the set list. I'm like, "I need a day." And he's like, "How can you do that in a day?" I'm like, "It's the first 5 Van Halen records. Like, right. I grew up on that. I mean, why would I need to rehearse that?" But I'm like, just for the sake of endings and stuff, let's get together and play. And that's all we did. We rehearsed a day and then we went and played.
Who else was in the band with you at that time?
It was Todd Jensen was playing bass, who I played with in Alice Cooper. And he, you know, he also played with Neil Sean. He was in Hardline. And he'd been playing with Dave on and off for about 20 years. Oh my God, who was the guitar player? I can't even think of his name. Brian was
John
the guitar
Five
player.
There?
And we had it was Brian. I can't think of his last name. I'm sorry. God, I apologize to him. I just drawn a mental blank. It was Brian Young. And Brian Young was in that Van Halen tribute band in L.A., I think Atomic Punks.
Right,
with
right.
Ralph from, right. You know, yeah. Okay, so
yeah.
So it was Brian Young. And Brian Young was an amazing guitar player. And we had this guy, Toshi Hiketa, who's from Japan. And that was it. So it was basically a four-piece band with Dave. So we did the one-off, and then I was just going to go home after that, and then Dave wanted me to stay in the band, so I wound up staying for 2 years. And, you know, the only thing that was kind of tricky is I was doing Montrose dates and David Lee Roth dates at the same time. So they kind of had to adjust a few things here and there. And if I couldn't make a Montrose date, then I would have Eric Singer go, if he was available. And Eric filled in a few Montrose dates for me when I had David Lee Roth dates.
what was your what everybody's got a rough story or experience. What did you find? What was it like for you working with them?
Interesting. yeah.
Do you want to leave it at that?
Dave, yeah, probably. You know, listen, I always got along with him well. It's fine. You know, he's definitely an extreme personality, and you know, sometimes he was really fun to hang with, but you know, he's definitely got his own thing going on. I mean, he's extremely, here again, he's really, really creative and really, really smart and really interesting. Like if you get him and you actually talk to him, it's like, it's really, he's really brilliant, but you know, then he's got the other stuff going on.
You know, I have literally like 5 minutes here before I have to end. And I want to ask you this because okay. I could talk to you more about bands that you played with. But when you run down, and we just scratched the surface here, and all these artists that you sure. played with, you know, Ozzy and Y&T and Rat and Megadeth and Suicidal and on and on and on. Did you, when you started your career as a drummer, I mean, it's got to feel great to be that guy that gets all these gigs and all these calls, because clearly it's it means, you know, what a great player you are and how easy you are to work with and make it all work. Black Star Riders, we didn't even get to talk about, but I love the records you did with them and love that band.
Thanks.
But would you have preferred your career up to this point had been like one band? Because if we're being honest, I imagine a lot of this is what they call hired gun stuff. Would you have preferred being a guy that was like part of an original band, Four Guys, Away We Go and Conquer the World, and a full member? Or do you like having a resume with all these different varied bands?
Well, you know, what's funny, I was thinking about that years ago, and that's a really good question, by the way. But, you know, I don't think, looking back on it, I don't think I'd change a thing, because I learned so much, because I've been full-fledged member of a band, and then I've been a mercenary, and I like them both. I mean, honestly, it's a lot easier to be a mercenary and just get the paycheck, where I don't have to worry about the accounting or the corporate taxes or the workman's comp or this or that. You know, I
or the ticket sale counts or something, made money or lost money. You get a check at the end of the week. You do your gig. You don't have to worry about the press. You go about your business.
Right. Exactly. So there's definitely, so the times when I went back and did that, I actually really enjoyed that, because it's really, really a simple time where, you know, I don't have to go into the accounting. I don't have to do this. I don't, you know, oh, we lost $1 million this year. Oh, great. Thanks. You know, I don't want to deal with that. But sometimes when you're in a band, you have to deal with those situations from a business standpoint. So I don't think I changed a thing. And I was thinking about, you know, a long time ago, like the guitar players I've got to play with, it's like, if you go down the list, it's like, you know, Jakey Lee, Dave Menichetti, Marnie Montrose, you know, the guys that I've gotten to play with, it's pretty astounding.
Yeah, it really is. Before I run out of time, what do you want to tell people about what you're doing now? I mean, like every musician, I know you're home because everything's shut down, but when things start up, do you have a band that you're attached to right now, or are you just going to see what's out there? Because the good thing is there's going to be a million bands hitting the road when they're able to, so there'll be no shortage of opportunity, I'm sure. But what, when things start up again, where are you headed?
I mean, right now, you know, before this shutdown, I have a local funk band I play with on the weekends that I really enjoy. It's like a couple miles from my house. I've been teaching a lot, and I'm still playing a lot. You know, I talked to a few people before this pandemic started about doing some touring. But, you know, the whole touring situation is going to be really interesting, because, to be quite honest, you know, I don't know about you, but, you know, I have in-laws who are rather, they're older. And, you know, I can't be around people, and I can't, you know, I'm not fearful for myself, but I certainly don't want to give this to one of my, you know, my relatives who are older, because they're at risk. So it's totally. the whole thing is really strange, because I'm like, even if someone wants to go out in like December or January, I'm like, do I want to get on a tour bus with five or six other people, and I don't know what they've been doing? It's just odd. The whole thing, it's just very strange. You know, I'm still trying to figure out how to get my mom out from Pennsylvania.
Yeah, Yeah, now there's a lot to still figure out, because even when the vaccine comes, it's going to take a little while for it to build up and people to trust it and know it works and be comfortable getting it. So unfortunately, it's going to be a bit of a road ahead of us. Hey, I got to wrap it up because they're going to play me off here in a second. But thank you so much, man. I'm glad we had a chance to do this. In normal times, we'll do a whole show, just sit in and shoot the shit, because I always love talking rock with you. We always do it when we see each other. We've not done it all that much over the decades on the radio, so I'm glad we were able to do it today. And stay well there, and hopefully we will, you know, get to hang in person somewhere soon. Well, thanks to Jimmy. Great to visit with him. Known him forever. And it was great to finally get him on the record on some of that stuff. I hope you enjoyed the conversation. And also earlier in the podcast, thanks to Frank Ferrer of Guns N' Roses. Check out the new music he has put out with his band Pisser, spelled P-S-S-R, if you're trying to look it up. All right, we've reached the end of the show. I thank you all for listening. I really do. It means a lot to me. I hope you join me every day on Sirius XM 106 Volume. Remember, listen to Trunk Nation daily if you're in the U.S. or Canada and you have Sirius or XM. And you can hear me live 2 to 4 p.m. Eastern Time, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Pacific every day, Monday through Friday. And, of course, you can also catch nightly replays 10 to midnight Eastern, 7 to 9 Pacific, all on 106 Volume. And you can also listen to full shows, audio, video, and more on demand anytime on the Sirius XM app. Be sure to check it all out. Check out my terrestrial radio show on radio stations across the country each and every week, syndicated, and of course this podcast each and every week as well. And keep an eye on my social media at Eddie Trunk, especially Twitter, where I am most active. Thanks to Katie Irizarry. She's the producer of the podcast. I'll see you next Thursday for another all new episode. Have a good one.
Myrtle Beach is the beach. 60 miles of bright sand, water, and a wealth of wonderful music playing day and night. You can step into a simple beach bar and discover a surprising level of exciting musical talent. A place to kick back and groove to the enticing soundtrack of the most unexpected vacations around. With nothing but good vibes floating through the warm ocean air. Plan your own music-filled trip to America's jukebox at visitmyrtlebeach.com.